They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast. On this episode, we're going to dive into early returns from the first couple of days of the NBA season, some of the extensions that got done over the last few days, and some of the extensions that didn't get done. Also want to talk a little bit about the injury to Zion Williamson. How concerning is that for the Pelicans? And it's not trade season yet, but there's one player that I'm keeping a very close eye on as we go forward with this season, a potential game changer that's out there on the trade market. Talk about that and much more. Happy to welcome back Jeremy Wu, SI.com, NBA writer, NBA draft analyst, and he's back here in studio. What's up, Jeremy?
Hey, man. Just, I'm here in Brooklyn. I was at the Kyrie 50-point game last night, which was a Nets loss, but it was just nice to be back at a game. I don't know how you feel, but just glad the NBA's back.
I would say it was nice to be back at a game, but I was at Sixers, Celtics, and Philadelphia, and if I close my eyes, I can still hear whistles because of the number of fouls that were called in that game. That was as sloppy an opener as I've ever seen, and we'll get into it. Some of it is quasi-intentional on the part of the 76ers, who are just a really physical team, but that was just bad basketball. So we'll talk about the game you were at, the game I was at, but I do want to begin out west with the Lakers and the Clippers playing their season opener. Of course, they get matched up to start the season. The rivalry is back. The Clippers make all those offseason moves. They bring in Kawhi Leonard, who looked like the old Kawhi Leonard that picked up right where he left off at the end of last season in Toronto. The Lakers, you know, they've clearly got some talented guys at the top with Anthony Davis and LeBron James, but they've got some lingering issues, certainly, on the perimeter. Give me, I guess, your takeaway from Lakers-Clippers for both sides.
Man, it was pretty fun to watch. Like, just the tempo of that game. Even on TV, you could tell that there was kind of an energy at Staples. I think the biggest thing I walked away with is that the Clippers, I don't know. It's super early, obviously, but I don't know how you beat the healthy Clippers in seven games. I just don't know how anyone is going to be equipped to do it. If Danny Green doesn't have the game of his life, the Lakers lose by 15 or 20 points, right? It was really fun, but also I think underscored some of the issues with the Lakers are going to have, and also just, you know, I think the fact that the Clippers are as tough as we imagined they'd be, and that was without Paul George, right?
Yeah. Paul George being out for at least the next couple of weeks with that injury. And they're going to be just so tough defensively when he comes back. When they bring out and they're able to roll out, you know, Patrick Beverley, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, maybe you throw Mo Harkless into that mix. The guys they have coming off the bench, they can, you know, mix and match certain lineups with Zubac and Harrell out there as well. Lou Williams, I mean, I didn't give Lou Williams my sixth man of the year vote. I gave the early nod to Terrence Ross. I think Terrence Ross is going to be great for the Magic this year, but it's like, it's how I felt years ago voting against Jamal Crawford, like at the start of a season, you know, because Jamal Crawford in his heyday was just like this unstoppable scoring force coming off the bench. That's what Lou Williams is. Now, there's an argument to be made that he could split some of the sixth man vote with Harrell if Harrell winds up getting enough games to qualify coming off the bench. But Lou Williams is just a monster. And when they bring Paul George back and they can put somebody else on that bench, I mean, they're just going to be flat out lethal at multiple positions. I mean, that's just a team that can defend. It can score. I'm with you. I don't know how you touch them in seven games, assuming Paul George comes back and is all the way there. But the Lakers, to me, are the most intriguing team because they're the team we just still don't know about. And they're the team that still clearly has a long way to go. Now, the shooting numbers were better than, you know, probably what the Lakers could have hoped for. I mean, they shot close to 40% from three, but those numbers are a little misleading. I mean, yeah, Danny Green going 7-for-9 from beyond the three-point line. That's, you know, that inflates the numbers right away. You had LeBron 1-for-5 from three. You had Troy Daniels coming off the bench, 1 for 5 from three. Quinn Cook missed all three of his shots. Caldwell Pope was supposed to be a sniper. He missed two of his three-pointers. So that's something that has to change. You can't just rely on Danny Green to go out there and play like an all-star every single night. I think he was a very underrated acquisition, and he was certainly someone that a bunch of teams had their eye on in free agency, but he kind of waited to see how the Kawhi stuff was going to play out before he made his decision. But you can't count on Danny Green to just carry you from beyond the three-point line. Somebody else in that group is going to have to start making shots for them to be successful.
Yeah, and I'm curious, obviously, Kuzma being out, I mean, that's going to be an interesting dimension for them. That's the thing I think we need to see before we can totally pass judgment as far as like the first, you know, first leg of the season, what that's going to look like for them. The thing that scares me is just the spacing is going to be an issue. And that, you know, that's why he's so critical, because, you know, if you do have Kuzma on the floor, you can play him with LeBron and Davis. If AD is willing to play center for at least a little, you know, at least for to close games, that's going to be big for them. He's going to have to do it, I think, just looking at how they looked this week. Because, you know, just with JaVale and Dwight out there, that was the biggest thing I think we can walk away from the first game and say, hey, I mean, the spacing is not going to be great. I mean, it cluttered up the lane for LeBron. It was harder for him to drive and kick. It sort of puts AD and LeBron playing the two-man game on one side of the floor. If you have JaVale or Dwight in the dunker spot, there's just going to be an extra guy in the paint. You know, it's not rocket science. It's not the best way to maximize the skills of those guys. Like, I don't think you want AD shooting as many, you know, tough contested twos as he took, as good as he is. So the personnel, I think, coming in was a clear structural problem with their team. And you look and, you know, Rondo will come back. That'll be interesting to see how they distribute those minutes. I think Alex Caruso will end up getting some run in the backcourt, because I don't think Quinn Cook is going to be the answer all season. And KCP, really disappointing game. They hoped he could guard some of these bigger wing guys like Kawhi. It's not going to happen. I mean, I don't think anyone can guard Kawhi. and it's going to suck for them all season, too, because the measuring stick is going to be the Clippers. And the Clippers already seem to be not fully formed, but clearly a formidable force that's going to be, you know, garnering a lot of praise, I think, the whole way. It seems like right now the only thing that can stop the Clippers is the health factor.
Right? Kawhi's like one of those guys, like, I don't know if you could plug him onto every team and make them a finals favorite, but he's the closest thing to it right now. The way he plays both ends of the floor, that you put him back on Toronto, they're probably the favorite. You put him on the Lakers with those guys, they would have been the favorite. And you put him on the Clippers with this group, and they're justifiably the favorite to win the whole thing. I mean, he's just a guy that doesn't really negatively affect chemistry, that plays on both ways, plays unselfishly. I mean, he's elite, man. I mean, I don't know if he's going to win MVP this year. I think there's, you know, going to be a strong case made by Giannis to win this year. I think Ben Simmons is going to make a strong case this year. But, you know, Kawhi's going to have his opportunities with that team to show he's just an elite kind of two-way player out there on the floor.
Yeah.
The Lakers, I think to your point about the size, Frank Vogel's going to have a conversation with Anthony Davis, if he hasn't already, and say, look, we need you to be predominantly a five. Like, we can roll Dwight or JaVale McGee out there at, you know, to start the game, so technically you're not a five man, but we can't play half the game with one of those two guys at the center position. We have to play smaller to increase that spacing. We have to get more wings out there on the floor. Our front court has to look like you, LeBron, and Kuzma, and then plug different guys into that backcourt. I mean, I don't know if one game is what you can judge Dwight off, but he looks a little rickety out there. JaVale is JaVale. Like, you got to have more spacing if you're going to be successful if you're the Lakers. And that's a conversation I think Frank Vogel has to have with Anthony Davis.
Yeah, and the, you know, it's early to say this, but sort of the underlying thing, you know, I mean, just knowing that Andre Iguodala is out there, knowing he's going to be on some other team, you know, by the playoffs. I mean, the Lakers kind of, if they can find a way to get him, they're going to have to get him, I think. The Clippers, you know, might get him, so the Lakers don't get him. I mean, you know, it's early to say that, but, you know, that's just an interesting, I think, storyline that is not going to go away either. Just the fact that he's out there. There are not a lot of guys that size, you know, defensively, which you need to beat the Clippers to defend Kawhi and Paul George at the same time, right? You need a guy like that. And so, you know, that's something else that kind of just was sort of in the back of my mind. But the Clippers are so tough, man. I mean, just the biggest thing with them is it's just, you took the toughest team in the league. These guys are nasty. They have an identity. And now they can back it up, right? I mean, Pat Bev can go say whatever he wants to whoever he wants, and he knows that he can just go pass it to Kawhi and they're going to score, right? So, you know, I think that as far as game ones go, I think there were some serious implications just from the performances of both teams.
Yeah, it's such a formidable, you know, point guard combination. I mean, you want defense, you go Beverly. If you want offense, you go Lou Williams. I mean, they can just do a variety of different things to you based on their rotations. It's just a treasure trove of weapons that Doc Rivers has at his disposal. So, yeah, I mean, that was a pretty strong statement to start the season for the Clippers. All right, let's talk about the game that you were at. Kyrie Irving and the Nets, they lose to Minnesota. And, like, I feel like we should talk about Minnesota. Maybe we'll put that off to another day. But as far as Kyrie in that game, goes for 50 in his debut with the Nets. It's a whole bunch of records when it comes to, you know, first performances with the team, opening night numbers, all sorts of stuff that I saw come across the wire over the last couple of days. But the Nets lose, not Kyrie's fault. It was a high-scoring game in overtime. They had a chance to win at the end. I don't know what to make of that final play by Kyrie. I saw some people suggesting, Jeremy, that Kyrie did that intentionally, where he fell down and tried to make kind of a circus act out of it. What did you see on that final? Before we get into Kyrie and the way he played, what did you see out of that final play?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I had to watch the replay. I could not tell if he slipped or if he tried to fall down and dribble around Josh Okogie. I'm not really sure, but I will say, like, only Kyrie is the guy who could get a clean look with the clock running down, lose your dribble, get it back, and still get off a very, very clean look at winning the game. I thought I was going to go in. It didn't. But, you know, it's amazing with Kyrie, and sometimes I think we forget, but just how effortless he can make it look when he's on. It was a very efficient, very easy 50, if that's possible. He was not really forcing shots. He was getting them off of screens in the flow of what they were trying to do. It just never felt like he was working that hard, and they were able to rest him a bit down the stretch. And, you know, granted, they did not win the game, and there were some plays in overtime where he was maybe being a little too aggressive. But, hey, I mean, if you're going to score 50 points and you're not going to turn the ball over once, like, you can kind of do what you want. So, yeah. You know, right? I mean, it's rare.
Of course. I mean, the guy was a plus 18 in a one-point game. I mean, that was awesome. Like, he was, outside of what Torian Prince, I think, was plus 19 in that game. But Kyrie was ridiculous. I mean, he took 33 shots, but he made 17 of them. Made half his threes, made 9 out of 10 free throws. I mean, had 8 rebounds in the game, which, you know, I didn't really see coming. And it reminded me, and I didn't see the game live because I was in Philly, but it reminded me that Kyrie, despite all kind of the shittiness of last season in Boston, had one of, if not the best, you know, season as a player with the Celtics. He was great last year as a player. He was a terrible leader, but he was great as a player with that team, and he's capable of this. Like, he is now in the prime of his career, and he's capable of maybe not going for 50 on a lot of nights, but giving you 30-ish type of points every single night. I'll tell you, again, I'm just sort of more reading the box scores on this and seeing some of the highlights, but if you're the Nets, it's good to see on a night that Kyrie went for 50, Caris LeVert doesn't get lost in the shuffle. He gets 20 points. You had Prince have himself a good game. Joe Harris had a decent game. Dinwiddie was okay in this one. He had 14 points, but he was solid. It's good to see that the younger guys around him, the guys that everybody are going to be watching all season long to see if they turn into the 2019-20 version of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, two guys that really struggled to play alongside Kyrie. It's good to see them get off to a good start offensively, and that, you know, even though Kyrie gets his, they're still getting theirs as well.
Yeah, and so structurally, I think the thing the Nets can do, which they've already, you know, the thing you saw last night, is having Caris LeVert and having Dinwiddie, you can play Kyrie off the ball a little bit more. It's not like, you know, Tatum is not really a playmaker. He's a scorer by nature. These guys are, you know, these are guys who can handle the ball and bring it up and get you into something, and you can use it to sort of run Kyrie off the ball. I mean, they did some good stuff. I think their best lineups are going to be Kyrie with Caris, and then either Dinwiddie or Joe Harris, depending on sort of what look they want to have. Torian Prince gave them really good minutes at the four. Jared Allen started the game. I would hope that he starts more than DeAndre Jordan. They say it's going to be a platoon, but I mean, realistically, I mean the benefit the Nets have this year is that expectations are not crazy. And, you know, beyond making the playoffs, you would think they are a playoff team. You know, beyond that, no one's really, you know, putting too much on them. You know, next year it's going to be a different conversation when Durant's healthy. But right now they can kind of explore looks and what they want to do. And you know, I think the ability to kind of spread it out, the ball is going to stick a little bit less than it did in Boston last year in theory. You know, there are fewer guys sort of playing for themselves in terms of agenda. I mean, you know, Brooklyn paid these guys, you know, their main guys have all gotten paid now. So it's just a matter of, you know, these guys, everyone's locked in for a couple of years. They can kind of let it click. And so I think that'll end up working in Brooklyn's favor.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're looking for any kind of red flags, you saw them in the first half when the assist numbers are really low and you started to kind of wonder, like, was this just going to be kind of the Kyrie show and, you know, your turn, my turn, which I don't think can be successful with that team. But they turned it around, it looked like, with better ball movement in the second half. More guys got their hands on the ball out there, so that's a positive sign. I'm with you, and I said this on a live podcast we did in Brooklyn a couple of weeks back. I mean, you know, other people have different opinions, but for me, if you're the Nets, a successful season is just not looking like the basketball Hindenburg, like not going out there and looking dysfunctional going into the offseason of 2020, because you already won free agency in 2020. You are the big winner. You're getting Kevin Durant back onto the floor at some point in that summer, and you're going to get him in the starting lineup, you know, no setbacks withstanding, at the start of the 2020-2021 season. So all you have to do is just look functional this year and not just be a complete dumpster fire. And this is at least a good start. Even though they lost the game, it was at least a good start that they're able to operate like that.
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, the ball will move a little bit better. They're going to have to get it inside better. I think Joe Harris is going to have to get – they're going to have to run more stuff for him. I mean, they didn't really – everything for him was in game flow. You'd think that you'd want to weaponize him a little bit more off the ball. You know, they're deep enough. I think in the East they'll be competitive. And also I just want to add, man, Karl Towns was great last night. He doesn't get enough love probably nationally, and until Minnesota starts winning, they won't. But man, he was really, really good. I don't remember what his final line was, but he does that all the time.
Yeah, no, he's special. He's a topic for conversation, I think, on
we can file that away for
podcast.
Later.
I do want to get into what I saw last night in Philadelphia. The Sixers, they took a win over Boston in their opener. That was as close to an unwatchable game as I've ever seen. I mean, it was sloppy. It was physical. It's just bad television on ESPN and bad for the viewers that were there. All that being said, there certainly are some takeaways, especially when it comes to Philadelphia. I mean, we knew coming in that they were big. They're big, and they are potentially great defensively. I mean, I watched Josh Richardson chip in a lot on holding Kemba Walker to one of his worst shooting nights of his career. I mean, he was all over Kemba. He was all over Gordon Hayward as well. I saw Ben Simmons without even... I don't think that Ben Simmons took a shot outside of the paint, but still dominated offensively. I mean, this guy was everywhere. When he was in the open floor, he was unstoppable. And when he had opportunities, he went down into the paint, mixed it up, pushed around Gordon Hayward, and just made plays for this team. I mean, I think Ben Simmons, I don't know if you call him a dark horse for MVP, because I think he's certainly in the conversation, but what I saw from him, what he does defensively, how he scores in the open floor, what he can do just night in and night out. I mean, he's going to be a candidate, especially if the Sixers are as good as we think they are. And I think they're really good. They have to find some shooting. There's no question about that. I don't know that it has to come from Ben Simmons, but somebody from that group of, you know, Furkan Korkmaz or Josh Richardson or Tobias Harris or some of those swing guys, somebody and probably multiple guys are going to have to emerge as a legit three-point shooting option. But if somebody does that, that's a tough team to beat. I mean, they're going to grind you down and hold a lot of teams to point totals in the 80s and a lot of nights. That's how good they are defensively with what they can do.
Yeah, having not watched the game yet, have not had a chance to watch the tape, so I'm not going to like get into specifics, but I do have a couple questions for you, you know, based on what you just said. I mean,
yeah.
So if you see Simmons as an MVP candidate, I mean, where does that put Embiid in that conversation? Like, how do you view sort of the balance there? Is that something that's going to be a problem for them? Or no, I mean, I don't know. And then my other question is just their bench concerns me. And I don't know how, you know, they're going to have to obviously pick up some guys because just looking at the names there, it's like they have very limited options, I feel like, in terms of depth.
Yeah, they've got – to answer your first question, you know, I wonder if, like, the Embiid for MVP discussion gets toned down based on kind of the load management they'll probably put him on. Like, I would – you know, Ben Simmons is going to play every game. Like, he's fully healthy. He's a workhorse out there. But I think this is going to be the year where you see Embiid scaled back considerably. Now, Brett Brown went out of his way to say before the game that Embiid had the best preseason he's had in his 5 years in Philly, that he's the closest to being kind of really in shape as he's been at any point in time during his career at the start of a season in Philly. All that being said, you got to treat him like he's fragile, right? I mean, you've got to, you know, load management, keep his minutes down to around the 30-ish type of range per game, give him some back-to-backs off, give him some of those three games and four nights or whatever they are, whatever the long stretches are nowadays in the NBA, give him some of that time off. You got to do it because you got to protect him and keep him ready for mid-April. Ben Simmons, you don't really have to do that as much. So with Simmons, I think you're going to have more opportunity for him to put up those kind of numbers and be consistent night in, night out. And maybe at the end of the season, the argument against Embiid is, well, he only played like 65 games and you can't really vote for a guy like mm-hmm. that. Maybe Embiid winds up being okay with that. Now, to answer your other question about the bench, I mean, it's fair. You know, Brett Brown said after the game, said, look, I got to develop a bomber or I got to grow a bomber, meaning he's got to find somebody from that Korkmaz, Mike Scott, Tybalt mix. Tybalt's a good defensive player. That guy's really good. You would know about him more than I would, but he is a really exceptional defensive player. So somebody from that mix, I think, is going to have to step up and be a more efficient scorer for them to get points with that second unit. I don't know who that is yet, but somebody in that group is going to have to play better.
Yeah, Tybalt is going to be a great fit with Simmons. Just the defensive versatility. I mean, really, even with Richardson, you know, he's so quick. His instincts are very, very good. You know, I think at Washington he was playing in a zone, but his numbers were just so off the charts in terms of just steal rate and block rate and, you know, the tape you watch him run around. I mean, you know, obviously now we see what he can do. I mean, my big takeaway from Summer League is just how far ahead of Zaire Smith he was. And granted, you know, he's older, you'd think that. But, you know, Zaire Smith is a pick that, you know, still we have no idea if it's going to pan out for Philly, right? So, yeah, the bench is just my main concern for them. They're going to want to have options in the playoffs if they don't want to go super big. You know, what are those lineups going to look like? Who are they going to be able to pick up? I don't know. But, you know, obviously a good start, I think. And, again, in the East, I don't really know. Beyond Milwaukee, which we already knew that coming in, but beyond Milwaukee, you know, who's really pushing them? I don't know.
Yeah, I tell you what, I'm dying to see how they play late and close games. We didn't see that against Boston. It was like early fourth quarter. They got a couple of threes from Korkmaz and Harris, and they pulled the lead up to 10. And when they get a 10-point lead, their defense is so good that it's tough to see them give it up. But what happens late in games? I mean, is Simmons the guy with the ball in his hands? He's still a little rickety on the free throws. You know, will teams foul him as he goes into the paint to try to force him to beat them at the free throw line? Will they back all the way off and dare him to make a three-pointer? I mean, I watched his shooting stroke in the pregame warm-ups, and I watched it with a couple of scouts that were sitting nearby just to watch, and it's kind of still the same. Like, he still shoots off one foot, which he's been doing for most of his pro career. The shot's still a little, you know, it's just a little weird the way it spins coming off his hand, and he doesn't really look for it in games. And, you know, everybody got excited about that three-pointer he made against the Chinese team. That was the only attempt he made in the preseason. Like, so we all saw the one three-point shot he took in the preseason. So is that going to have to be a weapon for him? Is somebody else going to have to step up? I mean, I think they have some perimeter questions that are going to have to get answered. But, man, I'm just telling you, watching them, as they get better defensive chemistry, they are going to be just scary on that end of the floor. They are going to lock people down and have some really give some teams some really ugly scoring nights out there on that end. So I'm interested to see how they play as that whole thing moves forward. All right, let's jump into some of the extensions that were handed out over the last couple of days. Some interesting deals were made for players. You saw Buddy Hield get a new deal in Sacramento. Jaylen Brown got a new deal in Boston. And I'll tell you, Jeremy, the Jaylen Brown deal – was the most interesting to me. Now, the Celtics, they have a history of not giving out rookie extensions. Before Jaylen Brown, it was Rajon Rondo back in 2009 that got an extension. They have a history of allowing guys to go into free agency and test the market. And I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of that philosophy. I think that's a smart way to go. I mean, you think about it. You saw Minnesota play last night. Andrew Wiggins played pretty well, but you think the Timberwolves wouldn't like to go back in time and not give Wiggins that extension and let him go into free agency that following summer and see what the market bore out for him? So the Celtics have had success with letting it go into free agency. They did it with Marcus Smart a couple of years ago. But I guess, and I'm kind of reading between the lines here, I guess with Jaylen Brown, they didn't want to run the risk that somebody would max him out next summer. And look, if Jaylen has a great comeback season this year, a bounce back season this year, which I think he's fully capable of, I mean, you know, we're only about a year plus removed from when he, you know, had a great postseason with the Celtics that year that Kyrie was out. So I guess if he had played really well in the season, somebody could have maxed him out. So getting him for, you know, around $100 million guaranteed, I guess there might be some value in there. But that was the one that I thought stood out just because Boston just doesn't have a history of doing that.
Yeah, no, knowing that next summer is not going to be a great free agent class, I can understand. I think you hit it on the head. I think it's, you know, cautioning against having to pay him more by just taking care of this now and then being able to structure it with incentives so it's, you know, it's not all guaranteed, right? I think the way that they went about it makes sense. I don't know if I value the player. I don't know if I personally value him enough that I would have wanted to hand him that much money. Also knowing that it's going to, you know, not, I mean, it'll set the market for Tatum too. I mean, when he becomes eligible for an extension, he's going to want the same or more.
Tatum though, Tatum's a full max guy. Like,
I think so.
Totally
I would hope so.
Out
right?
This year. He's full max.
I would hope so. But again, it just, I think you're sort of pouring a lot of money into two guys that kind of have some overlap in terms of skill sets and touches and, you know, now that he's under contract, I mean, maybe you can trade him later, but you know, it is a heavy price for a guy who still has a lot to prove. I think it might be an expectant price for what you're getting, but you know, Boston, they want to keep these young guys together now and sort of go with it. And you know, I think you had to, especially if they want to win this year, just having some security is going to, you know, make that process easier for them. But you know, it was definitely something that at a glance, I was like, not sure how much I believed in that figure.
Well, I looked at Tatum though, and I thought he might. The reason it was a surprise to me, in addition to everything I just said, was I looked at him at Brown rather as being a guy that would be the most likely candidate to be traded during the season. Mm-hmm. Still, you know, the Celtics, if you watch them in the preseason and you watch them against Philadelphia, their front court is not great, and especially defensively. I mean, Cantor was serviceable in that game against Philadelphia, but I'm watching them roll out Robert Williams and Grant Williams, who's a rookie, and you know, Daniel Tice is still around. These guys are okay, but you know, if the Celtics are hoping to make any kind of noise this season, they've got to get another big man in there. And now with this new deal, Brown effectively becomes untradeable because you now have to like account for that cap hit that he has coming up in 2020 and 21. So he's now locked in with this team, or at least for another year. And it makes you wonder, like, if it's not Brown and they're going to try to make a trade, which, you know, Danny Ainge is often want to do, who's the next guy to go? I mean, it's easy to sit here and say Marcus Smart because it feels like Marcus Smart, from the second he signed that contract, was looked at as a tradable piece. I mean, it's not an enormous contract. It's like $13, $14 million per year. It's certainly tradable in today's NBA. But it also made me wonder, like, is it going to be Gordon Hayward? I mean, Hayward, we have to remember, he can opt out of his contract after this season. I'm skeptical that he would do it unless he can find more security that's out there for to account for the $34 million he'd be leaving on the table in year four of that deal. But, I mean, Hayward's got a big salary. You could move that in a deal for another big man. I mean, I think it just created some more questions about how Danny Ainge looks at this roster because I don't know. I just don't think it's feasible that Hayward, Brown, and Tatum can coexist long-term. I just don't. I know that we play positionless basketball in today's league, but I don't think that Tatum is big enough to play power forward for that long a period of time. And while Brown was in the game last night, or on Wednesday night, he was playing some power forward himself. Like in, when he was out there, he was guarding Al Horford on that end of the floor. So I don't know that it's feasible to expect them to be able to play with those three guys significant minutes and be successful on against the good teams.
Yeah, they're going to have to stagger it out. And, you know, a big concern for me, too, is just knowing how pick and roll dependent Kemba is when he needs, you know, to be at his best. You know, you need to have a good, you know, pick and roll set up around him. You know, I worried about the spacing. I worried about who is going to be setting the screens. You know, Enes Kanter's fine, but he's not ideal for that role. And, you know, they're so perimeter oriented now. And even if you stagger the minutes for their, you know, the four main guys, I think there's some going to be some issues there. So I agree with you. I mean, they're going to have to do something if they want to, you know, be more competitive this year. You know, they have enough talent that they're going to get by a lot of nights. But, you know, now you're tying up all this money. And I agree. I mean, Hayward, knowing the injury he's had, I don't see how he can turn down that money, right? So I think a lot of questions to answer still for Boston. And, you know, they've done their best to kind of have it in a manageable place to start the year. But if it does, you know, if it doesn't work the way they want it to, I think there'll be definitely some shuffling of the deck.
All right, so think about your favorite pair of raggedy old sweats. You love how comfortable they are to lounge in, but how often can you wear them out of the house? Now, there's a pair of pants that you can do both. Introducing All Day Everyday Pant from Public Rec, your new go-to for style, comfort, and versatility. Public Rec's All Day Everyday Pants closes the gap between stylish pair and comfortable wear. They've reinvented the classic sweatpants design, starting from scratch where it matters most. Custom-made performance fabric and a tailored fit, indoor comfort meets outdoor style, the perfect pair for guys on the go. They're the first sweats that have waist and inseam sizing, so whether you're short or tall or somewhere in between, they fit perfectly. The design details, like the elastic waistband with internal drawstring, the two deep front zipper pockets, and the faux front fly for a more formal look. These pants are awesome. I first got them to wear around the house, but I like them so much, I wear them everywhere now. Now I can go from being at home to running errands or meeting up with friends. I don't even have to change. There are 9 different colors to choose from. These are called All Day, Every Day for a reason. Perfect for any dress code I throw at them. So here's how you get them. Go to publicrec.com/podcast and get 10% off your first pair of their All Day, Every Day pants automatically applied at checkout. And always with free U.S. shipping and free returns. Don't sleep on this rare opportunity to get a discount. That's Public Rec, rec spelled REC.com/podcast for 10% off.
All right, so what did you make of some of the other deals that were handed out? I mentioned Hield and the money he got from Sacramento. I thought the Spurs got a pretty good deal with Deontay Murray there at the point guard position. I mean, that's a solid, with $72 million, that's a solid contract for San Antonio. And I guess if you're Murray, you're coming off a knee injury, and you want to make sure that you get as much guaranteed dough as you can, so it makes sense from your perspective. But if you're San Antonio, I think you got yourself a good deal. Whether it's those two or something else, any of those deals strike you as interesting?
Yeah, no, Murray was the one I was going to bring up. I think the Spurs got a steal. I think it was 64 for 4 years. I think,
yeah, even less.
I mean, it's really cheap for a guy who's that young, you know, who has so much ability, and you know, for the Spurs especially, it's a coup just looking at, you know, the guys they do have. I think they're still trying to figure out which of their guards, you know, are going to be the guys long term. You know, Derek White, I think, came off the bench last night. Also a really good player. So, you know, being able to get a relatively discounted deal when you are trying to grow a young core is such a big bonus for them. And I mean, he's really good too. I mean, moreover, I mean, he's landed in a great situation there. He looks healthy. He was good last night. I think that's one that we'll look back at. Like, how did they manage that type of price? You know, I mean, Buddy Hield for 94, pretty good. It is a lot of money for a guy who, you know, is really primarily a shooter, but he shoots it well enough that you kind of got to meet it. Like, they would have been dumb to not pay him just because they're Sacramento and they got to keep guys. I think those are the two that really stuck out to me. It's not like
I thought the Sabonis extension was interesting, just because we still have no idea if Sabonis and Miles Turner can play together. Like, those two guys are going to get an opportunity this year to be center and power forward and center, whichever one winds up at which position. But, I mean, somebody of those two has got to emerge as a capable perimeter shooter for that to work in Indiana. And I guess both those contracts are certainly tradable, and both those guys are really talented players in different respects. I mean, Turner is certainly more versatile, whereas Sabonis is so efficient. I mean, he is a beast down there in the paint. I mean, he's just efficient with the ball. He's strong. He makes the right plays, seems like, every single time. But I don't know how they're going to play together. I'm pretty down on Indiana. I'm not just because, you know, from watching one game or whatever, but I'm still not sure that Malcolm Brogdon can handle an enhanced role that he's going to be kind of thrust into early on with Oladipo out. And I'm not sure how Sabonis and Turner are going to wind up playing together, but I guess Indiana saw a decent deal they could put together for Sabonis, and, you know, $77 million. I guess it can reach 85 in bonuses there, but that's going to be something to watch over the first few months, how those two guys play together.
Yeah, let me just say, like, I don't view Indiana as a lock for the playoffs. I think that there was a decent amount of, like, just penciling them in, but, like, again, we just don't know when Oladipo is going to be back. We don't know what he's going to look like, and it always takes guys time, right? So I don't think expectations should be that crazy for them this year. I get why they paid Sabonis what they did, just because I think it's a contract you can move. You know, it's a price you can move later. And again, being a team in a smaller market, it's valuable to at least have these guys under contract so that, you know, you preclude losing leverage trading them. You know, you get in front of that. And, you know, again, later on, they're not in a position where they can afford to lose anyone for nothing, right? And again, you can match in restricted free agency, but just getting in front of it now, keeping him happy, and then being able to keep your options open, I think is valuable. You know, and so we'll see how those fit issues play out going forward. I do think Sabonis is a good enough passer that offensively I can see it working, but Turner's really going to have to shoot the ball well. And defensively, again, neither of them are super fleet-footed.
Yeah,
so
they'll sort of be a team to watch going forward.
Yeah.
You know, the other one was weird. Joe Ingles. Like, not that I question what Utah does, because that's a really smart front office, but I have no idea why they gave Joe Ingles another year. He had, what, 2 years left on his deal? And he gets a one-year, $14 million extension. That's like a, I don't know, some kind of thank you for something out there. I like Joe Ingles, but isn't he going to be like 34 at the back end of that deal? Like, I'm not entirely sure what that was all about. Did that surprise you? Did that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, I don't know. It was a little weird. I don't know that they had to do it, or at least not now, right? But,
yeah,
this, you know, Utah.
That was something. It's like, all these deals are coming across the wire, so to speak, and I see Joe Ingles. Like, wait a minute, Joe Ingles, one-year extension? What? All right. I guess he's now signed through his age 33 season, so I guess he'll still technically kind of be in that sort of prime-ish window, but that was certainly a weird deal. All right, let's talk about something that's right in your wheelhouse, and that's Zion Williamson. Last week, Jeremy, we kind of sat here and talked about the expectations for Zion and just kind of what we saw from him in the preseason, how that would translate into the regular season. And then we learned days later that Zion's knee injury was a little more serious than initially feared. He had arthroscopic surgery on his knee, and he's going to be out for 6 to 8 weeks with that knee problem. So I guess my first question for you is, I mean, are you surprised by all this? I mean, torn meniscus in his right knee. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I can't say I was totally shocked that, well, I mean, it is surprising that it just happened so quickly. No matter who you are, it sucks getting hurt right before the season. You know, whatever stature you are, it's just, you know, not the best. But, you know, just knowing the way he moves, knowing how much muscle and weight he's carrying around, you know, I think you have to account for the fact that, you know, again, he's built to play basketball, but also it's just a lot of, you know, force every time he lands, every time he explodes, and so it's tricky to know, and I think David Griffin sort of hit it on the head when he. When he said this, it's just that he is it's such an outlier just from a physical perspective that, you know, they don't know. They're figuring it out as they go. And, you know, he's not someone who we can really compare to. You know, there's always a rush to compare him to past stars who've gotten hurt, right? But, again, his body is just so unique that it's hard to know. So I do think, you know, while obviously it sucks we don't get to watch him right away, I do think there is some long-term benefit. Like, it's better that he you know, now is just time to sort of slow play his return. And, you know, some of the hype probably will be a little bit dimmer by the time he gets back. As opposed to say, you know, he plays 20 games, they start off the year hot, and then he gets hurt, and then it's just, you know, the air just totally goes out of the team, right? So, you know, I don't think it's the if we're weighing bad things, the way that it happened was not the total worst thing or worst case scenario for them. And in long term, it's just impossible.
What is
to know.
This like? But is let me ask you about the long term part of it though. Yeah. Like, is this kind of an alarm bell that he can't be carrying around all that weight? Because that's what, you know, when I was just texting with and talking to different executives, you know, the first thing that came up was like, the guy can't walk around at like 290. Like, you just can't. I mean, I think he's officially listed at 284, but you can't carry that much weight on a 6'6", 6'7", type of frame. Like, is he going to have to, I mean, people talk about in that second year, you muscle up and you add the bulk, but does he have to go the other way? I mean, is he going to have to slim down to avoid this type of stuff in the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, I really just think it's impossible to know because he is so young. He could still grow. And that's just part of the challenge in terms of maintenance with him, right? But, you know, obviously, you know, the points people are making are valid. I mean, it is hard to be that heavy and move the way he moves. But, you know, as far as slimming down, again, that's hard to say because, you know, so much of his body – it's just natural. I mean, it's just how he's built. It's like, it's not like they haven't had him in the weight room, right? It's like, he doesn't need that. So I think the key for him is just trying to, and luckily they have a great training staff, which I think will help, but just figuring out the best way to maintain, you know, what is the right type of weight to play at. I mean, that's something that they can't answer. I mean, no one knows the answer to that. So, you know, just people are going to talk about it. But the truth is that there's, you know, I mean, we're not going to know. I mean, you just hope he stays healthy because he's such a phenomenal player.
I mean, look, I get that we're not going to know, but at the same time, and you can kind of extrapolate out a little bit that a guy that plays at or above the rim a lot of the time, and look, we talked last week about how, you know, that game he played against Chicago, he scored a bunch of points in the paint and he didn't dunk a lot of times. He was a lot of up and unders. And so he does have some finesse to his game. But a guy that plays with such explosiveness to continue to come down on that lower body with 280 plus pounds, that's tough, man. Like, that's tough. I mean, it didn't really, you know, it didn't come up too much in the last couple of months, you know, at least not as we watched him play in the preseason for sure. But the more you think about it, the more you have to look at it and say, well, that might be so. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if you can make your lower body stronger to protect against this type of stuff. But if you're continually coming down hard on that, you know, part of your leg, I think it does open you up to long-term questions. I mean, you're right about the medical staff they have in New Orleans. They poached the trainer from Phoenix, who everybody has been talking about for a long time. So, you know, and David Griffin and you know, he invested heavily in that medical department and all that stuff. But this has got to be like, even though the injury is not super serious right now, this has got to be, I think, a cause for a long conversation amongst the people in that front office about how they handle this. Because this is, I think this is something that could become potentially a long-term thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But also I think, you know, coming into the draft, no matter who you were, I mean, I think you had to, you know, account for that, right? I mean, and I still think there's no way you don't take him one. And I think ultimately, you know, that you take him and you live with it and you try to figure it out. But you know, from my standpoint, you know, that was something that I figured I almost factored in with him, was just how it might affect him. But again, I think that the potential of keeping him healthy just so far outweighs the negatives, and it's just, you know, I mean, we've seen athletes of all shapes and sizes have injury problems, and we've never seen anyone his size. And that's why it's such a hot button topic, because we all want to act like we're experts on biomechanics and whatnot. But, and again, it's easy to say, look at this and say, hey, this could be a problem. And guys, you know, he's already hurt, so it could be. But at the same time, I personally have just not spent so much time worrying about it, because it's just, you know, you just have to hope that he gets to a point where he can sort of hit a physical equilibrium where he can compete. And again, they may have to load manage him early in his career. Maybe you low manage him now and hope that by the time he's, you know, fully mature, 22, 23, you know, then you sort of roll it out and extend the minutes, right? So I don't know what the plan will be, but it's not. I guarantee you that they've thought about it, right? I mean, they have to have.
Yeah, I would certainly hope so.
Yeah.
You know what this sucks for in the short term is national television outlets, TNT, ESPN. Oh, what do they have, 30 games for the Pelicans scheduled this year? You know, if Zion's out for at least the first, what, 25-ish types games with this injury, oh, man, that's going to be a lot of Lonzo Ball and Brandon Ingram and, you know, television time for them. That's not, I'm sure that's not what those networks are signing up for. So we'll see what happens if they try to swap out some of those games in the first part of the season. All right, let me finish with some trade chatter here. And, you know, before the start of the season or for the last couple of weeks, we probably thought Bradley Beal was the most likely guy to potentially be moved. He was certainly the player that generated the most interest among the executives that I talked to who weren't sure how the Wizards were ultimately going to handle it. They said all the right things, but you never knew what was going to happen with Beal. Well, seems like he's off the table with that 2-year extension he signed, which will keep him signed on in Washington for, what, the next 4 years with the Wizards, which kind of turns the attention up to Cleveland a little bit and Kevin Love and what potentially could happen there. Now, Kevin Love is, I think, the most obvious trade candidate on the market. Like, the Cavaliers are going to be bad. No matter how good Kevin Love is, the Cavaliers are going to be horrifically bad. They've got some decent young talent there. I mean, Darius Garland, he's a decent prospect. Colin Sexton had a decent first year, but there's not a lot on that Cavs team. And I had one scout told me that, you know, looking at that roster, that's a roster that's kind of designed to lose. I don't know that John Beilein's going to be able to coax enough out of them to make them remotely competitive this year. So if you're the Cavs, what are you doing holding on to Kevin Love? So as you look around the league at potential landing spots for Kevin Love, are there obvious ones that jump out to you right now, obvious teams that you think will be looking in Kevin Love's direction?
Yeah, you know, I thought about this. I was actually last week talking about this with someone. I think, and you know, being that he is from Portland, you know, that obviously kind of brings them to mind. But I mean, that would be a fit. I think the Trailblazers are a team where I could see, you know, they're a team that is trying to win now. Hassan Whiteside's contract matches Love's contract very neatly, so that's a very easy trade to put together. If you know, the little haggle over whatever else goes in there. But I think that's one team you got to look at in terms of also, you know, what they're lacking. You know, if Nurkic does come back, you know, having a power forward who can space the floor, I think is pretty imperative. And, you know, what they do have right now isn't great at the 3 and the 4. So I think having Love as a spacing element would make a lot of sense. He'd be a great fit with Zach Collins. So, I mean, just at a glance, I mean, that was the first team that came to mind when I was thinking about, you know, where he might actually go. I don't know how you feel, but I mean, that to me is the very, very low hanging fruit.
Yeah. I mean, Portland has been a candidate for Kevin Love for a couple of years now. I mean, before they had all the success they had last season, I think there was some chatter about a Kevin Love, CJ McCollum swap. That's obviously off the table now as they continue to build around those two guys. I think Portland's there. You know, we talked about the Jaylen Brown contract. I thought Boston was a possibility because of how they play, as perimeter-oriented as they are and what they need in terms of front court help. I think Kevin Love would be a pretty good fit in that group. So I think the Celtics are certainly a team that you could watch out there. You know, Denver is another team I might look at. I mean, the Nuggets are pretty stacked right now, and you know, you could certainly make an argument that they're a co-favorite to win the whole thing. But I mean, you imagine Kevin Love and Jokic playing alongside each other. I mean, that is a really skilled front line that could do a lot of different things. I mean, Jokic. I mean, you got two guys that can step out and shoot the three, who can play make a little bit. You know, Love is not the greatest defensive player in the world, but he's been kind of serviceable over the last couple of years. So I think those are the three teams right now: Portland, Boston, and Denver, that makes some sense to me in that mix. I mean, I guess if you're looking for a dark horse, Indiana kind of makes some sense there because, as I mentioned, I mean, you know, Sabonis and Turner, like, I don't know that they're going to play well together or look like two guys that can coexist the next 3 or 4 years. You put Love alongside either one of those guys, and it probably makes a lot more sense, right? I mean, you know, Kevin's a better shooter. He can rebound the ball extremely well. So I think if you put him into that mix, you know, that could make some sense as well. And they're now, of course, down a power forward with Thaddeus Young being gone. So I think that they might be a dark horse for that mix.
Yeah, I'm interested to see if Cleveland can really drum up a market for him. There is a lot of long-term money there. There is some security in that if you're a mid-market team. There's some security in that. But, also at the same time, it is a lot of money for a guy who is, a little bit older. You know exactly what he is, and you really need that thing. So it is kind of a win-now move, right? And so Cleveland, I'm sure, will want first-round pick or two back. I'm curious to see if they will be able to get that.
Well, if it's a Hassan Whiteside-centric swap, as long as Nurkic comes back at some point and is able to play close to the level he was playing at, that makes a ton of sense. I mean, mm-hmm. Kevin's got the championship experience. I think he'd be motivated to go back home to Portland to play there. That's obviously a great locker room to step into. Lillard, as we saw in that GM survey, widely respected as a leader. I think he'd fit in extremely well with that group. The question would be, I think, what else does Cleveland want to squeeze out of it? Do they just want the cap relief that comes with the Whiteside contract in terms of what he has left on it? I think they'd probably want a little bit more. I think they can get mm-hmm. a little bit more for that. I think that you can get at least a couple of teams into a bidding war for Kevin Love that nets you at least a first-round draft pick in that mix for him. So I wonder how far Portland would go to go and get him. Now, they wouldn't give up any of their young guys.
Right.
They certainly wouldn't give up any of their core guys, but is there a draft pick or two? I guess it depends on what the Blazers think they are at this point. Do they look at themselves as being a team that is among those six or seven that are legit contenders in the NBA? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I thought it was curious they gave everybody extensions there. I mean, as far as I know, Lillard and McCollum are signed through like 2037 at this point. I mean, this was a team that, a year plus ago, we were talking about breaking them up, right? I mean, we were saying like, all right, McCollum and Lillard, they went as far as they could go. All of a sudden, they go on a run. They get to the conference finals, and we're talking about them as a team to kind of build around or a group to kind of build around. So I'm just curious to see how that whole season. They're a very unpredictable team to me in Portland. I think they could wind up back in the conference finals again, or I think they could wind up losing in the first round again. I think they've got great variance once they get into the postseason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think part of why Love also makes sense for them is just that the length of his contract does kind of, vibe with, Lillard and McCollum getting paid. I mean, I think they view Zach Collins and Anthony Simons as, long-term, very valuable players. I would agree. I love both those guys. So, I think they're hoping that, by the time that those guys sort of roll over onto their second contracts, they are be able to, remain competitive. So, I mean, maybe you throw in Gary Trent or, they have all their first-round picks. So, they have some stuff they can send to Cleveland and, however they want to do it. And, Cleveland already has, their two guards who they're trying to build around. So, it sort of complicates what they'd want back in any deal, right? I mean, they probably don't need backcourt help long-term. But, also their roster is just so barren right now that, they'll probably take what they can get. I'm curious to see how quickly a deal could happen, how long. I mean, there's probably some value in waiting for, a team to, get desperate or start to feel like they really need to make a change. It'll be a little while. I would hope that we see Kevin Love in the playoffs this year.
Yeah, I would also say, the longer you wait, I mean, Kevin's had, he's not a checkered injury pass, but I don't think you want to run the risk of him getting hurt at
right.
some point playing on a team going nowhere, because you got to get something of value for him. Like, you signed him that contract, and, you signed him when you had Ty Lue as your head coach, and, great. You said you were going to go one direction, then you went the complete opposite direction shortly into that season. But I don't think you want to lose him to any kind of injury and wind up getting nothing back in exchange for him. Right now, his value is probably at its highest. It's going to be at least over the next couple of years. I think you'd want to move him sooner rather than later. So maybe like mid-December, you kind of pick your best offer that's out there and make that deal. But that's certainly – he's the guy now that I think everybody's keeping their eye on with Bradley Beal now under contract. Jeremy, always appreciate it, man. Terrific stuff. Keep up the great work. I know you're going to be jumping into the draft stuff very, very soon, so I'm sure we'll catch up to you and talk more a little bit later down the road.
Absolutely. Thanks, man.